There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Truth and Movies from Little White Lies. Today, Guardians of the Galaxy 2. Yes, it's another Guardian podcast. Flicks with 70s hits, decidedly mixed, say critics, but is it just young, dumb and full of gun? We give our thoughts. We also talk favourite movie soundtracks, Spice World obs, but what else? And salute Lady Macbeth. Florence Pugh goes from bodies to bodies in William Oldroyd's punishing drama. It's all in this first ever Truth and Movies podcast. Establishing shot, interior, three men sit around a table. They are David Jenkins, Adam Woodward and James Richardson. It is Shoreditch. Then someone speaks. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this inaugural Truth and Movies podcast. I'm here with David Jenkins, very much the editor of esteemed movie magazine Little White Lies.
Hi.
Hi to you. Hi. And your digital counterpart, Adam Woodward.
Yep, hi.
Hi to
He's not digital. He's not a hologram.
Right, okay. No, that's a fair point, actually.
We should establish
He does the online stuff, which is, what's the website?
It's lwlies.com,
right, littlewhitelies.com. Does anybody know what the title means, Little White Lies?
That's a very closely held secret.
Okay, all right.
Which we may reveal in a future pod.
What are we doing with this podcast? What's the idea here, David?
So, yeah, we're a movie magazine, Little White Lies, and we've been going for around sort of 12, 13 years now. And, we've primarily been a print publication, and then we've expanded it online, and now we want to talk movies via the podcast medium.
By the way, if you want to talk back to us here at Little White Lies, you can do so via the website. Adam was just mentioning lwlies.com. You can also get in touch on email, truthandmovies, all one word, at tcolondon, all one word, .com. Or you can follow Little White Lies on Twitter, which is always a good idea because you guys put up all sorts of interesting things. And the Twitter handle is at lwlies. Looking forward to hearing your reactions, I think, to this debut show, which begins with Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Eagerly anticipated sequel, this one out on Friday the 28th of April and set to the backdrop of Awesome Mixtape 2. This sees the team's adventures continue as they unravel the mystery of Peter Quill's true parentage. It features Peter Quill, played by Chris Pratt, also Vin Diesel's along, Dave Bautista, Bradley Cooper, Zoe Saldana, Michael Rooker. They're all back, basically, for this. And here's a little clip of the action.
All right. First you flick this switch, then this switch. That activates it. Then you push this button, which will give you 5 minutes to get out of there. Now, whatever you do, don't push this button, because that will set off the bomb immediately, and we'll all be dead. Now, repeat back what I just said.
I'm Groot.
Uh-huh.
I'm Groot.
That's right.
I'm Groot.
No! Now that's the button that will kill everyone! Try again.
I'm Groot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Groot.
Uh-huh.
I'm Groot.
No! That's exactly what you just said! How is that even possible?
Fine performance there from Vin Diesel. One of his best, I would say. Now, David, you reviewed this, and your line was...
Uh-oh.
It's like your uncle wearing a Sonic Youth T-shirt. What does that mean?
Well, I guess my feeling about this, and maybe this extends to the entire Marvel Universe, galaxy, solar system, is that that there is a definite kind of like attempt to be cool, attempt to be down with the kids, attempt to sort of talk in a way and act in a way that's really like hip and happening, but never really quite comes off for me. You know, they got the look, but right. they don't really have the credo behind it that's right. backing it up. The real kind of the passion, the soul, the spirit, you
it's
know.
It's an empty corporate shell of hypnosis, you think?
I think so,
Adam,
yes.
you're demonstrably down with the kids. So do you agree with David?
I'm inclined to, I think, in this,
really?
In this case, yeah.
Did you notice that the rather older guy next to you was having a terrific time during the film?
There was a chap sat behind me who was whooping
right.
with every sort of 80s reference, and they range from sort of Pac-Man to Knight Rider and all the music, which we'll come on to
range.
Later.
Which
is a big range. And yeah, I think it was just that instant recognition of, I get that reference, and there's the joke, basically.
Right. I was actually referring to myself, because I right. really enjoyed this film.
But you know what? I actually thought, because I was sitting in front,
yeah.
and I could hear this man whooping, and I thought, that's James. He's having an absolute ball. I'm so pleased.
There you go.
You were having
no,
a ball,
I did enjoy it. I feel you guys should do more of that reviewing stuff first, and then I'll say what I think. But, I mean, I can say it now if you like.
You should just say it.
I'm just going to come out with it. I actually enjoyed this film more than the first one. I know that this one didn't have the kind of surprise that a lot of people felt like, wow, this is a bit outside the normal Marvel paradigm, which is one of the reasons I enjoyed the first one. For me, the first one kind of traded on goodwill that it hadn't actually earned yet, because we never met the characters before, and they sort of turned up expecting us all to love them just because they had a funky 70s soundtrack, or actually a pre-funky 70s soundtrack, which is quite quirky in itself. This one, because I was already familiar with the characters, actually I really got off on the humour, and I thought Bradley Cooper, I can't think of a finer film vehicle that he's had, probably not since Wet Hot American Summer. It's a film with Vin Diesel, which is watchable, which is quite an achievement. And I thought it was funny. Wasn't too bothered about the plot, but it's kind of a throwaway film.
The interesting thing is that with the first one, I remember when it was announced and prior to it coming out, I don't know if I speak for everyone here, but certainly from my standpoint, anticipation was not high. And I think that the first film was successful because it was quite, like, it was like, oh, that
right.
film that we had really no expectations for is actually pretty solid and quite funny and has some good tunes in it.
Right. So your review, basically slating this movie, is all about allowing people to enjoy the sequel.
I wasn't slating it, do you think?
It did come across quite negative. I think you gave it 2 in your special ratings. I think you gave it a 2 out of 5, is that right?
Two in retrospect. I think Marvel films in general are a kind of an instant sugar rush.
Right.
They are a kind of boom in the moment. Your eyes are kind of firing up, but then when you've left the cinema, you're not thinking about the film.
Right.
There's nothing to gnaw on.
Okay, it's pop culture, basically.
It really is.
Okay,
yeah.
But I would argue very successful pop culture. Adam?
Mm. I think it's very successful in what it does, which is essentially glean all of this cultural cachet from, as we talked about earlier, so many different references. The problem, I think, is that it doesn't really try and do anything interesting or original or particularly inventive with that. It's just throwing stuff in there for people to recognise. The jokes aren't particularly well-crafted in that sense.
Well, that's interesting, because you mentioned in your review the fact that James Gunn, the director, his comic timing, or at least the way he's put the lines together, I think the payoffs are actually really funny. And I think I thought that was maybe one thing we'd all agree on. That
I think the delivery of the jokes, the scripted jokes, is very, very good. And we talked about Dave Bautista is amazing. His comic timing is just spot on.
I think he works best more as just a general comic presence. You know, he can say anything and it will sound quite funny. Whereas I think a lot of the other characters have, air quotes, lines that they
right.
have to like
Did you
say.
Think Bradley Cooper was funny?
No, I didn't laugh
really?
At Bradley Cooper
Did
once.
Did you laugh at him in the first one?
No, no.
Oh,
I mean, it, for me, there was nothing there. It was try hard and silly and...
Really? Okay.
Yeah, no, didn't... Bradley Cooper, no, he's not a funny man.
Okay. it's opinions, I guess.
Yeah.
I thought that the chemistry, the casting in this was really good, because I think Dave Bautista's great. I personally enjoy Bradley Cooper, but, you know, get why you maybe wouldn't. Curiously, when I saw the first film the first time, I didn't enjoy him. It was only when I re-watched it that it came alive for me. So I don't know, for me it got 2 thumbs up. But if you want to use a slightly less Stone Age rating system,
can there be more than 2 thumbs up?
Yeah.
Is it just one or two or zero?
As I say, that's a bit binary, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let's in your excellent magazine Little White Lies and website, you employ a rather radical rating technique. Could you just explain a bit more, David?
Sure, yeah. So we instead of having a simple 5-star review, which covers the entire movie experience, we sort of segment that up a little bit and have an anticipation score out of five. How much are you looking forward to seeing this movie?
From like going to a funeral, which would be like zero or one.
Zero, one, two maybe, if you like funerals. And then enjoyment, which is intended to be your experience in the moment of actually seeing the film, that kind of, you know, I think what Marvel movies are all about is that kind of in the moment sugar rush. And then in retrospect, which is like when you've left it to mature a bit in your mind, you've had a time to ponder, and then you kind of you get to see the kind of the enjoyment over time. It's a graph.
I like that. Okay, so what would your numbers be for this?
So my anticipation was 3, which is quite kind of measured, I guess, because I think that all Marvel movies are essentially the same. That's maybe a conversation for another day. But like, so anticipation is modest, I would say, personally. And then in the moment, it's a long film. It's 2015. It took a very long time for me to realize that the story had started, and that there's lots of like, these people are doing some things over here, and these over here, and it's all kind of tease until you get to a point. It's like, oh, that's the story. Oh, okay, fine.
It's essentially a film made up of subplots, and you talk about the chemistry of the ensemble, and I'm with you there.
Yeah,
and I like a lot of the characters, but they kind of go their separate ways a little bit in this film, come back together at the end. You're never really sure who you're meant to be following or whose story you're meant to be more invested in. And the theme of this film is sort of family reunions. And everyone has their respective paternal, maternal, and sometimes sibling issues going on.
Right.
We eventually get to kind of resolutions with all of those. But by the time all that arrives, I just couldn't find myself caring about
really
any of it.
Really interesting. Okay. Because I would agree with you, but I think you may be viewing the film in the wrong context. The plot in this is just a giant MacGuffin, if you will. It's all there to enable this dysfunctional family dynamic to play out, because that's where the fun is, that's where the laughs are. And I think that's clear from the word go, when you have this opening sequence, which sets up as a kind of classic action movie showdown between this vast tentacled creature and the assembled guardians. And James Gunn, the director, as soon as the alien arrives, basically just takes the camera off, focuses on the baby Groot figure, and lets his dance to ELO's Mr. Blue Sky occupy center stage while you just see kind of bits peripherally of this vast action scene taking place in the background. Essentially, it's not about the action, it's about the characters, it's about the laughs. One thing, listening to that clip of baby Groot there with Rocket, you might think, is baby Groot really annoying? Did you think he was annoying? I quite liked him.
Oh no, I would say that I thought the baby Groot character worked. If anything, I thought there was less of him than I thought there would be. Really,
right.
He has kind of maybe 3 sort of meaty moments in the film, and I mean, you know, I think that's maybe a sign of the sort of dearth of quality of the writing, in that they maybe couldn't think of some more ways to incorporate him into the movie, in a more meaningful way, but. You know, I think that there is a sort of a sketch in the middle of the film involving Baby Groot, which was the highlight of the film.
Okay.
And it's a really nice, it's one of those, it's just a really nice sketch that involves good writing, good editing.
Is it when he's fetching things?
It's when he's fetching things.
All right.
But going back to that opening sequence, the way James Gunn stages the action off camera is such a clear nod to the fact that this is just about the jokes.
Yeah.
And yet the film actually unfolds in a way where the action is very much at the centre of it. And it kind of, I feel like it sits out its stall in that opening scene and then doesn't really deliver on that.
Okay. All right, so your score's worth 3 for anticipation. And then while you were watching it?
It was 3.
Three while you were watching?
It was maybe 2.5.
2.5, okay.
So I'm giving it the benefit
of
the doubt. And now I'm sort of 2. I'm just...
Really?
I mean... The fact
you
that,
regret
the very it. Fact that we can maybe have this conversation about it, and that it's still in my mind in a semi-fresh way, I think would prevent it from being a kind of a complete write-off. But like, if someone said, if I was on like a long-haul flight and that was the only film that I could see, I probably would like read the safety card
really?
Or something.
What, having already seen it?
Yes, yes.
You wouldn't rewatch it?
No. There's no.
Actually an interesting measure. On a flight, would you watch this again? Adam, you're on a flight?
I would watch this again, I think. I mean, my expectation was quite high. I quite liked the first film. It felt like a bit of a palate cleanser, felt quite refreshing.
Mm-hmm.
I think Marvel movies, especially up to that point, had become very serious. And this one, you know, it was admittedly a 2-hour sketch or series of sketches, but it did its job really well, and this one sort of does the same thing. So I was sort of expecting quite a lot from it, and
we'll give it a 4 expectations.
I'd give it maybe I'd give it a 4. I'd probably say 3 for enjoyment,
right?
And maybe a 3 for in retrospect as well.
Okay.
The one thing that really depressed me about the film was that in the screening we were at Monday evening, James Gunn, the director, was sort of on stage beforehand, and he said it was a film made about outcasts, for outcasts.
Did he say that?
Yeah. And I think that's totally disingenuous. Like, the idea that these characters are outcasts in the context of the film, but
right.
This film, for me, is the epitome of the kind of commodification of geek culture. And that is right the way through the film, and also the marketing campaign, which is obviously heavily focused on the soundtrack, all the kind of references to stuff. I mean, one of the posters is a kind of nod to the Ramones' Rocket to Russia LP. And, you know, that's not necessarily part of geek culture, but it's certainly more of an outsidery thing. And that sort of feeling that the film thinks it's quite punk and quite cool.
Is that not a sign that the geeks have essentially inherited the earth?
Yeah. And but this is basically, it feels like this is as good as it gets for these films. Like, it's not trying to really push it that far.
Okay.
It's giving you something which is as David said earlier, a real sort of in the moment sugar rush, that really, you know, you don't really take much away from it. And I don't know, I just think I'd like to see these films trying to be a bit more ambitious. I would recommend it to people who like these films.
All right.
And not recommend it to people who don't like these films.
That sounds fair. I myself was not anticipating a great cinematic experience, particularly after an hour we sat while the DJ tried to whip up enthusiasm for the first film's thing. But so I wasn't very up for it when the film started. Loved the film. Feel a bit sheepish now that clever people have told me I shouldn't have. But
no,
I think
no,
I would still give it a 3 going in, a 4 at the time, and a 4.5. In retrospect. No, I'll give it a 4 in retrospect. See it, I would say, but clearly at your own peril. Anyway, speaking of scores, the soundtrack is, of course, key to this movie and its whole character. So, in a second or two, we're going to be talking soundtracks. Sweet sound of Richard Jupp out of Elbow on the drums there. That's right. Hey, anyway, so like soundtracks, which this mixtape thing that they've got going on, which quite cleverly they've gone pre-funk. They've kind of mined an almost untouched strata of musical history with all the kind of early 70s classics. I don't know if it's a little bit cynical, but it does work. It's a kind of shortcut to sentiment, pre-made fuzziness.
Interesting fact about the first Guardians of the Galaxy, and this is actually from an interview I did with James Gunn at the time. He basically said that he downloaded every song that charted in the 70s. Ended up with this mega playlist, which he whittled down to about 100 songs, of which ultimately some made it onto the soundtrack. But this was actually at the script stage. So he actually wrote a lot of the film with these songs in mind.
Right.
Which I think is a great, a great idea. And now it just feels like, we're sort of a few years and another film down the line, and suddenly it's become this, quite cynical marketing exercise.
But that actually, to me, makes it sound quite organic, the way that he's approached this.
Well, initially, and I wonder whether, the success of the first film very much seemed to depend on that mixtape volume one. And this new one, people are talking about the mixtape or the new soundtrack as much as the film.
Right.
The film production company have clearly not missed a trick on that, really kind of heavily pushing that.
Well, one of the things about this film, actually, that I think is quite strange is that I found myself enjoying the music much more than you're hearing the music with the visuals. You know, like hearing George Harrison's My Sweet Lord, which is a song I'm partial to.
Mm-hmm.
It was nice to sort of be in a big room and hear that song. And whether there was some sort of like crazy psychedelic visuals happening at the same time was kind of apropos nothing.
The crazy psychedelic visuals at that moment are actually the biggest visual effect ever made, according to the people who made it.
Never.
Apparently so. Mm. Interestingly, the first soundtrack album was the first ever soundtrack album consisting entirely of previously released songs to top the US album charts. I mean, the soundtrack album, this kind of jukebox soundtrack, It's something that's been done brilliantly before. Tarantino's famous for it. I think that Danny Boyle is another famous exponent. I mean, Trainspotting is genius. Does it always work that way, though, with the director basically going, that sets the tone, that's the tone I'm looking for? Or is it usually that the record company comes in and says, hey, can you shift these songs for us?
I think it works probably both ways. Certain directors, Martin Scorsese, Wes Anderson's another one, they seem to essentially use these songs as jumping off points at the script stage. You know, they really work them into the film in ways which, yeah, feels organic and actually has some bearing or some relevance to the actual story.
Right.
One of my personal favourite soundtracks is Gross Point Blank.
Right.
Great 90s film, John Cusack. That film opens with an amazing scene of John Cusack lining up to essentially assassinate a guy. And as he's kind of looking through his sight, the song I Can See Clearly Now comes on. And I mean, that use of that song perfectly encapsulates the mood of that film, the tone of that film. And it also sort of talks a bit about the character, reveals something about who that character is. Mm. I just felt like with Guardians of the Galaxy 2, James Gunn doesn't really nail that. You know, the songs for me didn't really marry up as well with the action and what's happening. There's a few uses of songs as well. The Cat Stevens song, Father and Son.
Mm.
I mean, it's a little bit on the nose, isn't it?
A bit heavy-handed, you feel?
A little bit.
You guys put out a shout on the Twitter for great soundtracks. There was a lot of love for Gross Point Blank and its kind of 80s vibe, 80s English vibe.
Yeah, there's sort of The Clash and is that kind of thing.
Other much-nominated films included 500 Days of Summer. Somebody had a shout-out for Shrek. Of course, Till the End of the World, the Wim Wenders one. Oh, yeah. Donnie Darko, The Big Chill, Scott Pilgrim. Casino. You mentioned Scorsese, Orma Brown saying that the scene where Sharon Stone seduces Joe Pesci to B.B. King's The Thrill is Gone. Of course, from Goodfellas, fantastic soundtrack there. I'm amazed nobody's mentioned Everybody Wants Some, because I don't think there's a film in which the soundtrack played as big a part of my enjoyment as that one. I mean, maybe you needed to be a certain age when you saw that, but that was just because none of those songs I was expecting to pop up in an American film, a Richard Linklater film. Suddenly you got pop music by M or Tainted Love by Soft Cell. I was just glorious. That's my favourite.
I love the idea that he's kind of, instead of thinking like, what songs do I love that I just want to put on the soundtrack, he's basically thought, what would these people be listening to?
Yeah.
And it becomes part of the character. I mean, my personal favourite of these kind of jukebox movie soundtracks is, I was trying to think back to like, what would be the kind of, almost like the grandfather of these, like, the, you know, when did this whole thing kick off? And maybe someone can correct me over email, but one of the ones I love the most is the American Graffiti, the George Lucas one.
What's on that?
It's
Beach Boys.
It's like the Beach Boys. It's loads of 50s rock and roll, basically.
Right. It's surf rock.
And lots of soul, surf rock. And I mean, the whole point of the film is like, it's kids in cars listening to rock and roll on the radio and smooching and going to diners and stuff. And the way that the film is made, you know, you'll be in one car with one character listening to the music, and then you'll kind of be taken across to another car, and the sound kind of merges across, and you hear what they're listening to, and it's like this kind of, the whole film is essentially, you know, encapsulate this idea of like a kind of youth soundtrack, and like, you know, the importance of music in the kind of, as a kind of lubricant for life. I think it's an amazing film. George Lucas film.
Yeah, whatever
I think.
Happened to him?
Yeah, I don't know. He's just went missing.
Just disappeared.
But that's a great example of a soundtrack. I mean, that film was made 20 years or so after the 50s, but it perfectly captures the spirit of that time in a way which I think this film, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, doesn't quite do that. I know it's a different kind of film, and it's obviously set in a fictional future in space. I get that it's what Peter Quill is supposed to have grown
it's
up listening to.
It's actually a fictional present in space.
Fictional present. Mm. I'm not convinced that the whole backstory of how he comes about these mixtapes is very sort of sweet and it's a nice kind of character detail. I just think that there's a limit to how much you can kind of run with that. I feel like the film has sort of run out with ideas of how to actually use that.
Just one thing about the Sony Walkmans used in this film... Mm. The prop master had to build them because they couldn't find any intact Tony Waltman. That's amazing. I can't believe that. I can't believe that.
I saw a great thing today, which was Doritos.
Oh, yeah.
Have teamed up with the Guardians of the Galaxy people, and they've brought out a limited run of big bags of Doritos with essentially the soundtrack built into it. So you can plug your headphones into the bag.
Into the bag of Doritos?
Into the physical bag and walk along eating your nachos and listen to the soundtrack.
So the bag of Doritos features an MP3 player?
I don't know exactly how. There's some compartment inside whereby you plug your headphone jack in.
Right.
I mean, it sounds like one of those things that people would talk about on a podcast but never actually, you know, experience
right.
in reality.
Yeah.
Maybe if someone has experienced that.
Yeah, actually, if you've seen one of these Dorito bags, let us know. Next up, let's talk about a film that really doesn't have a jukebox soundtrack, or indeed a soundtrack of any kind, and that's Lady Macbeth.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Right, Lady Macbeth, which disappointingly no relation to Shakespeare's Macbeth. It's not part of a series, Macbeth Meet the In-Laws, Macbeth Family Values.
Yeah, like Abbott and Costello. Or
exactly.
Like that,
yeah, none of that. This very much an adaptation of Nikolai Leskov's novella, Lady Macbeth of the Mtsensk, more recently remade. There was the Shostakovich ballet, I think, no? And then the Yugoslav 1962 Lady Macbeth of Siberia. Which we've all watched, listeners.
Yeah, yeah.
We've all watched that. Anyway, this is from William Aldroyd. It features a pretty extraordinary Florence Pugh, Cosmo Jarvis, Naomi Aki, Christopher Fairbank, Paul Hilton, in a pretty harrowing story about a young woman who is bought as a wife and essentially held almost captive in a country house.
Have you kept well?
I have. Thank you, sir.
You haven't been running the house in my absence.
I have.
That wasn't a question. Where's your husband?
Wherever you put him. I'm so sorry.
It's not a cheery business, Adam. What was your take on this?
I really like this film. Couldn't be probably more different to Guardians of the Galaxy 2. It's a costume drama, I think, for people who may not necessarily like costume dramas. And you talk about the novella on which it's based, which is obviously set in Russia, and this is the story is sort of moved to 19th century kind of Northumberland. I still think, even though Game of Thrones has been around for a long time, it's still nice seeing sort of regional accents in period dramas. It's a story of a young woman who is brought into essentially quite an abusive relationship, and it's how that abuse is suppressed by her, and for reasons which we sort of won't spoil here, she is sort of left to her own devices, and it's how that abuse then manifests itself and how she passes it on to the people around her.
It's been a while since you've seen this, David. Is it all flooding back to you now?
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, I think the Game of Thrones reference definitely feels appropriate. I mean, I remember watching it thinking it was kind of like almost like Game of Thrones fan fiction, but in a good way. Like, you know, someone had sort of spun off a character because it has that kind of, that sort of hair trigger violence and that sense that anything can happen. And
right.
I mean, the film, sort of dramatically, the film is set in this kind of country house. And, you know, it's people in rooms with doors closed. And then William Oldroyd actually is from a theatre background. And you can kind of tell in the way that he sort of surprises you with people come and entering through doors. And, you know, suddenly, you know, she'll go out into the barn and there'll be, and she'll see some weird things happening out there with the sort of stable hands. And, you know, he that element of surprise works really well, I think. And and I guess that Game of Thrones does have these kind of, well, I mean, whatever you think of it, I mean, it does have these quite intense, brash performances and that are quite sort of, how would you describe them? They're quite meaty. They're quite sort of...
The Game of Thrones.
Yeah, this one's more dialed back.
Yeah.
But it still has that sort of sense that, you know, I think Game of Thrones is a sort of series that gets, that sort of discusses the idea that people can be really horrible to other people,
right?
And I think that carries over into later.
It's interesting this film in that it goes out of its way to be kind of unsympathetic as a viewing experience almost. There's no, we talk about the fact there's no music, the sound of the house is dialed up to make it actually quite a jarring listen. Equally, the characters really don't do anything to any affection that they might build up. They don't do anything to retain it particularly. And the figure of, what's her name?
Catherine,
right, the heroine, is really interesting figure. I mean, as you say, you don't want to spoil what happens, but the way that her being, almost her nature being repressed, how then she deals with that, it's kind of fascinating.
What I love about this film is the mystery around that character. You don't really know anything of her backstory. You don't know kind of what she's been through. She's obviously a young woman in this very male-dominated world. Mm. But there's not a sense that this is something that's entirely new to her in terms of her being in this house, being brought into this marriage. I just love that sense of intrigue around who she is, where she's come from, what she's maybe capable of as well. I mean, you talk about how it kind of leaves that so open for so long in the film. You're never really not sure what her next move is going to be or what she might do next. And actually, sometimes she does things which are quite kind of shocking in their abruptness. Mm. And in any other film or in a film like this, which maybe handled it in a different way, it could maybe seem a little bit farcical or absurd, but this totally feels like within the characters.
Right. Abrupt is a great word for this film. Overall, then, you really liked it.
I really like this film. Probably fairly low expectations. My anticipation for this would be a 3, I think. First time writer-director. Although Florence Pugh, I mean, she's someone who, I think this is her first sort of lead role, but she really stood out in a film called The Falling, Carol Morley film, which I wasn't so hot on personally, but the performance is amazing. She's not really in it for very long, not to kind of give anything away, but she really sort of stands out in The Falling. Yeah.
Okay. She's going to be doing the lead in Fighting With My Family, it says here, a film written by and directed by Stephen Merchant. It's based on the life of professional wrestler Paige.
Ah.
Yeah. Her brother is Toby Sebastian, who plays Tristan Martell in Game of Thrones.
Well, there you go.
Oh, gee whiz.
I didn't actually know that.
I didn't know that either.
Brilliant.
Cosmo Jarvis is in it as, you know, farmhand, horny-handed son of toil.
Yeah.
And not just his hands that are horny either.
Indeed.
Anyway, and he's a singer. I wasn't aware of that at all. So basically, your expectations weren't wildly high.
Weren't wildly high. I think, you know, going in not really knowing what to expect from it.
Right.
But yeah, a 4 for me and same for retrospect, I think.
All right, 4 at the time and 4 afterwards.
Yeah.
Right. David?
So yeah, my anticipation would be sort of moderate. I think I'd heard some good rumbles from the festival circuit. I think it played in Toronto, and At the end of last year, and where it got some good write-ups. So, yeah, I was quite eager to see it. So,
all right.
But and then enjoyment. I mean, this is a weird one because, like, you know, I like the film, but wouldn't necessarily say it was an enjoyable experience. No. And, I mean, that's when you kind of have to fudge things a little bit. I mean, I'd probably give it, again, it'd be like a 3.5. And I might say 3 rather than 4.
Airplane safety card for this one.
No, I probably would give this one another go on the airplane. Okay. Yeah, I thought it was very good.
Yes,
but I'm not. It didn't quite have that sort of transcendent quality that I need for it to sort of be very, very good.
It's a beautiful film to look at.
Mm.
The costumes, the furniture is amazing. If you like furniture, you're going to love this film, and it's lovely.
That's the poster quote there.
Yeah, if you love furniture, and the framing, the way it's shot. I didn't know his theatrical background, the director, but it's lovingly put together. Like you, I didn't have wild expectations, although the trailer is quite dramatic and makes you think that, yes, it is period, but it's going to do interesting things with the genre, which it certainly does. So I'd say a 3 going in. I'd give it a 4, and I wouldn't really want to go back on that because nothing that I thought of afterwards made me think... Do you know, I think, if anything, it's kind of brewed in my head this notion of the morals or absence thereof of that story structure. Huh. So, yeah, Lady Macbeth.
Go see it.
I didn't give mine in retrospect.
Did you not? I thought you did. What was your in retrospect?
Oh, I was going to say that my in retrospect would probably be a bit higher, 4.
Oh, yeah?
Because actually, after having a bit of time to think about it, I do think it's a really interesting depiction of a kind of female character who is kind of... I think that character who's quite kind of, morally slippery, shall we say,
right,
is generally quite a male preserve in cinema, and it's really interesting that it's a gender fluid film in a way. I think that it's playing with genders and roles and things, and interesting in that respect.
Certainly is interesting. All right, well we're going to have another little bit of drumming, you know, because we got him in. And then we're going to come back with a very exciting development, which is our Little White Lies film club, with a very special piece of movie making. And also I get to go off on one about Fast and Furious 8, and you guys tell me what you're excited about right now.
Sure.
Sounds good.
Right then, how about that Little White Lies film club? What's this about then, Adam?
So Little White Lies is all about helping people to discover more great movies. That's kind of our remit, I suppose. And yeah, I think it would be a good idea if we sort of offered up a film for people to go away and watch. We're going to do the same thing,
mm-hmm,
and then come back next week, discuss it briefly.
Brilliant. What have you selected for us?
So, interestingly, James Gunn, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 director, I saw a thing on Twitter where he'd responded to someone who was programming a screening event where they were showing, I think, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, and they'd asked James Gunn what films they should show beforehand, like essentially what influenced him in this film. And the films he tweeted back were Flash Gordon.
Right, so you went with Flash Gordon. Yeah.
Well, Empire Strikes Back and 2046, the Wong Kar-wai film.
Right.
So I think of those, you can maybe see a little bit more of the Flash Gordon and the Empire in Guardians 2. But 2046, I think, is a film which I certainly wouldn't have said going into this is going to be a kind of key James Gunn influence. So
it is one of the most amazing films to look at, like, ever.
Oh, yeah, it's incredible. I remember originally going to see that in the Odeon Wardour Street, which is now no longer in existence. And it was just me and one other guy eating a kebab.
Who was eating a kebab?
The other guy. I wasn't eating a kebab. It was the other guy. So right. I saw it in kind of smell-o-vision.
It's a shame he wasn't eating Cantonese food. Cause
no, that would have been nice. And especially, it's in Chinatown as well. Yeah. So it would have been, getting a kebab in that area would have actually been harder.
He would have had to go out of his way to get that.
Yes.
2046, just for anyone who's wavering, could you sell it to them, David?
It's the Wong Kar-wai sequel, unofficial sequel to In the Mood for Love. It's a more ambitious, surreal, cerebral experience. It's got his kind of trademark extraordinary visuals. It's a love story set inside the mind of an author, and it just sort of hops around all these different genres, and it's a kind of... A kind of brain melter, but in a really good way.
Right. So the plan is that we would invite you, listener, to go away, and if you have a chance to see this, it's certainly available on Amazon, or perhaps you can pick up a DVD copy somewhere. Then next week we'll have a bit of a chat.
Yeah.
Yeah?
And then also have another recommendation for the following week.
Okay, something appropriate to next week's films.
Yeah, yeah.
Our Twitter address is at LW Lies. The website is, Adam?
It's lwlies.com.
Bingo. Or you can email us at, and this is where it gets complicated, I've lost the piece of paper. Do you remember the address?
I do. It's Truth and Movies.
All one word.
All one word. No ampersand. At tcolondon.com.
Bingo. I went to see Fast and Furious 8 this week, and that only served to kind of...
Why did you do that?
I was curious. And also, I liked three of the first seven.
That's less than half.
Yeah, but the seven itself, and, you know, potentially this is to do with the fact that tragically Paul Walker had died and there was that rather touching scene at the end of seven, which I think left every... It invested this series, this deeply silly series, with a certain emotional significance, which I think people have brought into the new one, which is possibly why, and crazy stat here, it's had the opening weekend that it had.
Yeah, Fast and Furious 8 actually made more money on its opening weekend than The Force Awakens. I don't know the exact figure to hand. We'll have to find that out.
Are you sure about that?
The Force Awakens.
No, yeah. I simply refuse to believe that.
But the apparently it's true, David. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Until Universal studio head is telling it to me to my face, I won't believe it.
I've got the numbers now.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So The Force Awakens, 529 million worldwide in its opening weekend, which is impressive. Fast and Furious 8, 532.5. So that's like 3.5 million more. It's tight, but more people got excited and went to see the new Fast and Furious film than the first new proper Star Wars film in decades. Now, it's, you know, fair enough. Horses for courses, and it's a matter of taste, but it's rare that I come out of a film so... Do you know that feeling when you feel that you've actually been insulted by the filmmakers, that it was essentially insultingly bad? And that's very much why I'm still... Oh my goodness, I have to get something off my chest about this. I don't want to go on about it. There are one or two good bits. None of them involve Vin Diesel, because we were talking about the chemistry and the casting of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Mm. The casting of this, I find it astonishing that 8 movies on, they've not realised that Michelle Rodriguez and Vin Diesel are just charisma deficits. There is literally nothing that's interesting or charismatic or sympathetic about them. And there's a couple of interesting set pieces. The remote piloted cars, the kind of swarm of them in Manhattan's good. And there's a kind of, I imagine, a homage to Battleship Potemkin that the Staith reenacts in an airplane. But, you know, see that on YouTube if you can, because it upsets me that I have contributed to the funding of this creatively, morally, artistically bankrupt movie, which features another bad performance from Helen Mirren. I know she's a great actress, but she's really made some stinking appearances on film.
I will say that was the low point for me. And in fact, she kind of did this before in a film called Red.
I was going to say
a few years ago.
Yeah.
So it didn't really come as, you know, it didn't really feel fresh or particularly funny.
Yeah, it's like no one wants to say, Helen, that was actually really bad, because it's Helen Mirren.
I think this film, though, you said that it hasn't kind of realised how bad some of the actors are.
Right.
For me, it relegates the original cast members. And Dwayne Johnson is now MVP, and there's no messing. And he is like the future of the franchise.
And, they basically the Staith.
And the Staith. Who actually, he is extremely funny, the Staith. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if there's anyone... The Rock has a very different kind of... gives a very different kind of action comedy performance. But Statham, as a sort of go-to hard man... You wouldn't really expect it from him.
One of my things on Statham is I think that he is an extraordinary film actor, and he has that rare thing of like he's in a lot of bad films,
right?
But I always like him in them.
Did you see Wild Card? His Las Vegas debt collector.
I didn't see that.
Oh,
one.
It's a great film.
Oh, maybe I did see that.
Where he takes people out by flicking cards at them at one point.
Oh no, but that sounds perfect.
Yeah,
I mean that's what he should be doing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And have you seen Crank 2 High Voltage?
No, I haven't.
Right.
The premise there, though, is fascinating. He's got a drug in him which, if his heart rate slows, will kill him.
Jason Statham essentially has a car battery for a heart that he needs to recharge.
Right.
Periodically. And but I mean that's the premise itself is sort of intriguing, but the film is just totally bonkers.
Okay.
And just watch it.
Going back to your quite valid point that the filmmakers have spotted the fact that Vin Diesel's a bit of a bust, etc. Mm-hmm. Believe that this week they've announced all plans have surfaced for there to be a spin-off, Jason Statham and The Rock. They're going to get their own movie, basically, characters.
And that's not going to be Fast and Furious 9.
I don't know whether it'll be canon or not, where it will exist in the Fast and Furious.
FAF canon.
Yeah, but this one is effing bad. I wouldn't go and see it, not if you paid me again.
on an airplane.
on an aeroplane. Just before we finish off, we've got 2046 for next week. Anything else that's got you guys excited at the moment?
Well, I guess that I'm just prior to coming here, there was a release of a new poster for a forthcoming Wes Anderson film, which is always an exciting prospect, called Isle of Dogs.
Right.
I don't think it has anything to do with the post-pub rock Isle of Dogs.
Or the actual place.
The actual place is down the river, yeah. Or maybe it does, I don't know. It's not been made yet.
It would be just like him.
It wouldn't surprise me if it was. But
looking at the cast, there's nothing there that says to me that it's based in Docklands or anything.
No.
It is an extraordinary cast. I can't remember. You guys mentioned this. I just called it up. And there was an audible gasp from me when I read Scarlett Johansson, Jeff Goldblum, Bryan Cranston, Tilda Swinton, Edward Norton, Liv Schreiber, Bill Murray, Frances McDormand, Greta Gerwig, Cara Haywood, Yoko Ono.
Yeah, you've got to have a villain, haven't you? I mean, this is... So we should say it's a stop-motion animation film. So it's I don't know if you've seen Fantastic Mr. Fox.
I have.
So it's, I guess, in the same vein as that.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine most of those people will have minor parts.
And it's actually been made in England, in the UK.
Yeah. Right.
It's been, so the production is happening right under our noses.
Wow.
But I'm of the belief that Fantastic Mr. Fox is one of Anderson's best.
Really?
So it's pretty exciting seeing him go back to this medium.
So yeah, anticipation is top whack for this one. Five.
Super. All right. Well, of course, another sequel that's in the works is Truth and Movies Part 2, which release date of potentially sometime around next Wednesday.
We hope. Anticipation.
Well, that'll be up
we'll
to,
leave
the
that to the listeners,
I guess.
Yeah. I think we're going to be talking about Mindhorn.
Mindhorn.
Which is a comedy.
So they say.
British comedy.
The trailer suggests otherwise, and I'm actually going to be seeing it tonight.
Yeah, you're still sceptical, aren't you?
I certainly am.
Let's not say anything about it, though, to prolong the magic of our analysis next
week. Right, okay. Anyway, this has been the very first ever Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast of featuring Adam Woodward and David Jenkins and myself. Many thanks to everyone at 7 Digital for putting it together. And as we say, we should be back in a week's time. So have a super time, all of you. Until then.